RTI.
Radio Tatras International, from the heart of Europe to the world.
Just before we start the show, Postcard from Poprod would like to send our thoughts and our wishes to the families of the victims of the awful bus crash in Switzerland earlier this week. We all know by now a number of children were killed on the return journey to their homes in Belgium. There are even reports now of an English child on the coach, but we just thought we'd begin the show with by showing some respect to the victims and the families. Anyway, here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's that time of the week again. Time for Postcard from Poprod. This week with me, Lee G. Banks, sitting on the zit on the nose of the face of the universe. That's the UK. And you also notice this, ladies and gentlemen. It's only me can actually say that properly. Do you know that, Eric? And in the beautiful snow-covered mountains of Poprod, we have no one. Eric's off showing some of his Slovak techie chums how to tune in the radios and something like that. I don't know what he's doing, but it's something very important, ladies and gentlemen. It always is when he leaves me to look after this. And in Paris, whinging and moaning and whining as usual, it's Gerard Poppadom's best mate, Mark Gander.
Yeah, hello there. Well, Paris, what beautiful day it is here. I must say the temperatures are getting very nice. And if we could just move this over to sort of southeast of England, it would be wonderful. But there we are. It's not. No, hello, everybody.
It is absolutely teeming down with rain here at the moment. Honestly, it was yesterday. And, you know, I looked out the window yesterday and I thought, this is terrible. I'm not going out in this. I thought, I'll pick the kids up from school tomorrow. Honestly, it is that bad.
Hmm.
That was a joke, Mark. You could have laughed.
Well, I'm just really trying to figure out because I don't think you've got any kids at school.
Is this how it's going to be?
Well, I'm in for truth and reconciliation, actually. So,
anyway, let's get on. Let's make a start here. And I don't make any excuses for starting with this story. I inherently, probably the same as Mark, can't agree with war. But equally, I can't defend the ripping off of the people who lay down their lives for us when wars take place. Yes. And that's what's happened now. Six former armed force chiefs are calling on George Osborne to reverse his unjust pay cut for Britain's war-weary troops in the next budget. What do you think? How can they actually cut the wages of the people who are going out and dying on our behalf?
Well, I have to say that, I mean, I can't remember in particular the specific instance in the past, but this seems to be not uncommon kind of complaint that the troops who, they choose to do the job, but at the end of the day, it's very difficult and very dangerous job, and they are representing the rest of us. And let's say we're not in a war economy. We're not talking about the First World War or the Second World War here, where there are serious economies to be made. We may be in difficulty, but I still think that to send these people out there and then to start talking about wage cuts for them and so forth and caps on benefits and things, it just seems really extraordinary. And
well, they don't even earn much, do they?
I don't think they do, actually. I've got an idea they do, because apart from anything else, I don't know if people realise, but in fact, deductions are made for things like sort of bed and lodging and all this sort of thing, you know, which is quite amazing. I mean, what do they expect them to do? Go to Afghanistan and then at 5 o'clock come home? It's just really, you know, a bit silly.
I think it's outrageous. I really do think it's outrageous. Because apart from that, they've got to buy their own, substantially buy parts of the kit. Yeah. That they use out there, and people, the families are actually shipping things out to them because their lives are so awful.
Yeah,
and for this government, I've never ever voted Labour, and I've never ever particularly wanted to vote Tory. But when we had a coalition, which really, as everybody knows, is just a toothless. It's a toothless dog that's being
shaved by Cameron and his glove puppet.
That's right.
It?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, we know where he's got his hand all the time. Yeah,
exactly. But at least we thought that as a country there was a chance that we might be able to do something because of the revolutionary aspect of all this. And what do? We put benefits up for people. We take benefits off other people. And then the very people who are out there defending our way of life, Whether they should be there or not, that's debatable as well. But the people there, we start to cut the wages. They don't earn a great deal. If they were on £100,000 a year, and if you go out and lay your life on the line in any other form of you know, they're actually trying to cut the pay for police as well. That's another thing, isn't it? They're the other people who lay their lives on the line for us. What is it about? Well, Why do we not?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, the whole thing does seem extraordinary. And what amazes me more than anything else, that, I mean, here we're at a point in the life of the government where really the government needs to make decisions that appeal to the public. Because I think that people are really losing confidence. I think people are really losing respect for the government and for the coalition. And so to do this kind of thing really is just the poorest kind of publicity. What on earth are they doing?
Well, this is also, but I do genuinely believe there is a sense of draconianism there, a sense of showing off that we are a draconian government. We cut right to the quick. We make a decision and we stick to it. And yet they make U-turns left, right and centre. Why don't they make a U-turn on something like this? Why don't they then go for the big vote that would say, yes, at least this government has actually got a heart? Because up to now, all you've seen is the heartless, smug... the smugness of this, of the people at the top of our world now who are running our world, like the bankers, how they protected the bankers, how they pretended to pillory them. And yet the bankers are still making fortunes out of running the world economy into the ground. I think it's shameful. I really do.
Yep.
But I think the next bit that we've got on the running order this week shows the sort of thing that our troops are having to face up to. The Taliban. We all know what the Taliban is, you know, but they've pulled out of peace talks.
Yes.
Peace talks to end the Afghan situation. What do you think to that? Why would the United Nations particularly want to talk to the Taliban? That's what strikes me. The Taliban, which all Taliban means is students, and they were only in power in the 90s for 5 years and were accused of all sorts of brutal repression of women and all sorts of terrible things that they carried out against their own people. Why would we want to talk to them? Why would we consider putting them in power?
I think that we want to talk to them. I mean, I think we've been driven to it, quite frankly. I mean, you know, we've got, 250 years experience now of
losing wars.
Of losing wars in that particular region. And it looks like we're about to sort of do exactly the same thing again. I mean, the Russians couldn't sort it out, the Americans couldn't have sorted it out, and we can't sort it out. And we're driven to a position now where we want to be able to leave, at least having said that we've established something and that we've achieved something. So from our point of view, it's very important. And at the end of the day, now we're having to start thinking and talking to the Taliban. The Taliban now are pulling out of the peace talks because of this tremendously tragic and unfortunate rampage that's being carried out by these US soldiers. And to a certain extent, sorry, but if the Taliban are going to be a party that's going to want to negotiate, because peace talks means finally negotiating and establishing, you know, conditions under which the Western forces are going to leave, then the Taliban, to a certain extent, have got to be taken seriously, I suppose. And we have here a man who maybe unfortunately was very ill, who's gone in on a rampage, killed a huge number of people, including, I think, 9 children. So I'm afraid, on one hand, you can't really, you know, be surprised the Taliban are pulling out, partly because maybe they really do feel hurt and insulted. And of course, the other thing is the Taliban will want to use this as a bargaining chip. And that's exactly what's happening.
I think that's right. And I think that's exactly what they're doing. There is a point, obviously, you know, to talk to groups like the Taliban and people like that isn't exactly new. As far as the English government, you know, we talked to the IRA, for instance.
Yes.
But really, when the IRA did some terrible things, as we know, I was actually reporting in Northern Ireland, and they did some terrible things, but I'm not so sure that they were as bad as the Taliban. And why would you really want to put the Taliban in charge of a country that, like you say, Mark, we have been so afraid of for so long?
Well, I have to say that, you know, as for putting the Taliban in charge, I mean, it's not our country, and who are we to put anybody in charge? I mean, I must say, I feel tremendously sorry and maybe even responsible as, if you like, sort of an outside force that's tried to have a hand in it.
Yeah,
if once the Taliban get back into power, I think it's going to be shocking and frightening for maybe people who've taken advantage of the absence of the Taliban for the moment. But it's to say, you know, who are we to put them into power? This is somewhere where really we shouldn't be going. We're not in the business of putting anybody into power.
Let's do a quick straw poll between us both. Do you actually know why we're out in Afghanistan?
Well, the original reason was really because we decided it was the seat of terrorism and we wanted to get rid of that. And I think that we have done because, unfortunately, rather than just extinguishing the problem, as far as I can make out, they've all moved on to somewhere else.
Well, I was going to say, isn't the seat of terrorism now Pakistan?
It's either Pakistan or it's the Yemen or even Somalia.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I mean, this is a problem. I mean, we're dealing with a very, very fluid opposition. But I think that's the reason why we went in there, why we haven't pulled out, why at some point much earlier we didn't sort of signal, right, job done, and now we're going. That I find difficult to know. And I suspect that maybe in the aftermath, in the post-mortems that are absolutely going to happen, people will start saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, the job was done a long time ago. Why on earth didn't we go at the time?
I agree 100%. We're not going to have a row this week, are we, Mark?
I'm going to work on it soon.
The only thing is, if we do have a row, and one of us goes off sulking, the other one's in trouble. Right, anyway, yeah, moving on, because, again, it's quite a serious beginning to the show this week, and I don't make any excuses for that, because I think there's a lot of serious things have gone on. A lot of shocking things, a lot of things that make you feel sick to your stomach. Yeah. And one of the most sickening things, as far as I'm concerned, is what the leaders of Syria have been doing while their people have been dying on the streets, while they're all for war. They've been going on eBay buying things.
Yes, I think the we've somehow, I don't quite understand how we've gotten to know about it, but apparently some emails have been revealed which show that Bashar Assad and his wife have been going on huge internet spending sprees.
10,000 pounds worth of candlesticks and tables and chandeliers were shipped from a Paris designer to them.
Why do they need so many candlesticks unless they're expecting power cuts? I really don't know. I mean, it is, you know, quite extraordinary. And I don't understand why, you know, Western organisations are still being allowed to do business with them. I mean, that seems amazing at all. But I am going to say that although it is shocking and it's sensational to get a pair like this, who, quite frankly, are going to end up like the Ceaușescus, who were eventually assassinated on Christmas Day a few years ago. In a way, this is, yes, I mean, it's an interesting piece of news. But the real news is that the slaughter, the wholesale slaughter and genocide is continuing. The murder of children, the torture of men, women and children is going on. Nothing really is being done about it. And it's so sad that China and Russia won't come along and basically give their seal of approval that some real action is going to be taken. I mean, I have to say that, you know, should we be in Afghanistan or should we be in Syria? Leave the question open.
Well, I think, yeah, and I think what you say is right, that this is what would be called in news circles a sort of sidebar to the main issues, which is the terrible things that are going on there. But I think it's an important piece of journalism and an important thing for newspapers and TV to report on, because it does show the kind of despotic awfulness of the people who are in charge of these kind of places. One of the emails that came out says it was from Asma, the president's 36-year-old British-born wife. Remember, she was brought up in Britain. She said, and in the email she says, "I am absolutely clueless when it comes to fine jewellery." And goes on about she was awaiting delivery of gold and onyx and diamond encrusted necklaces, and they were being made for her in Paris. And she says at the end, "Kisses to you both, and don't worry, we are well." And then signed off, AAA. That wasn't, you know, it's outrageous that is how removed from the reality of what is going on there these people are. And really, are they that removed, or are they that shallow that they don't care?
I have to say, it does beg a belief. I know.
I think it's shocking. Listen, let's move on. Let's get a bit happy. Yeah. Let's do something a bit lighter. Because this world is a terrible, terrible place, really, isn't it? But there are things that can go on. And here we have it. The Rolling Stones everybody's not going to get stoned because the Rolling Stones have cancelled the 50th anniversary tour.
Yeah, I mean, that's how amazing. I mean, if it's 50th anniversary, surely it's 50th anniversary. And they're postponing it now until 2013. Are they going to call it their 51st anniversary tour?
I know, honestly, what's happening with old Mickey, eh? I think it's incredible. Why would they do that? Why would they do that? They say that everybody's there, everybody's well, everybody's happy, everybody's capable of doing it, but they've just put it off for a year.
And Keith says, we're just not ready.
Well, they've been played long enough together. What do you think of the Rolling Stones? Did you like the Rolling Stones?
I did. I've always loved the Rolling Stones.
I thought they were really cool. What do you think about them now?
I think they're great.
I don't
have any problem at all. I think they're absolutely great. And of course, now, you know, they just sort of settled down producing their music. They settled down making their money. I mean, they're really running a business, but I don't have a problem with that. They're very entertaining and loads of energy, and they're super, yeah.
I saw them back in, I've seen them three times now, but I saw them originally back in, I suppose it would be, I'm trying to work it out. I was married to my first wife. We went there, we had a row there. So that would be round about 1986, and that was in Leeds.
That was only your 51st anniversary, wasn't it?
No, I don't think we even got to our second.
All right.
But, you know, it was really good. It was really, the beauty of it was, I didn't like the Rolling Stones particularly. I still don't particularly like the music. I think things like Sympathy for the Devil are classics, and they've alternated between being genius and being average. But the energy, the absolute energy that you got from the concerts in Leeds was phenomenal. And the way everybody moved, the way that Keith Richard was so intimidating, the way that, Mick Jagger, the old wobbly, him, right? He was just phenomenal, very, very effeminate in a way, but also incredibly masculine and sexy, just a strange androgynous character.
Did you rather like him or something?
I'm ambiguous. That's what I'm saying. If you listen to me, he said we weren't going to have a row.
Well, I'm not having a row, but I just think
there's something about them. There's something about the Rolling Stones that obviously, if they've kept going for 50 years, that means it's got to be something good. But I saw them again, about 3 years ago.
Yeah.
The last tour was, and from a distance they looked the same. It was just like the Rolling Stones had recreated themselves and gone back to the 60s. There they were on the stage, and Keith Richard was there. Then you started to notice the gnarled hands, the way his hands had deteriorated. He's an old man. He's an old, wild old man, and I respect him for his wildness. But then also Mick Jagger came on. And I'm afraid it was a bit like watching your granddad dancing at a family party.
Was it really?
Yeah, he was putting his heart and soul into it. But you know when things are just hurting a bit and you can't quite do exactly what you want to do and it all looks a bit staged and a bit funny and a bit sort of awkward. That's the way it was. Whereas the next person we're talking about, his Royal Bobness, right? He, same age, in his 70s now, giving the best shows that he's probably given in the last 30 years.
Yeah, but he doesn't have to prance around, does he?
He does now. He's never pranced around in his life. And now he's become like this sprightly old eccentric gentleman.
Really?
Honestly. Yeah, he actually dances and he smiles and he laughs and he looks at the audience. And sometimes he just stands there singing at the microphone. Sometimes he plays guitar and everything. He's just incredible where that silly Billy old Mickey... Mm. Whatever he's called, yeah, he's a bit of a geriatric loser now, where his Royal Bobness is just stunning. I love his Royal Bobness.
Do you think the listeners know who you mean by his Royal Bobness?
Of course everybody knows.
Who do we know? Who?
Everybody knows who his Royal Bobness is.
Oh, I don't know.
Lord Bob of Dylan.
His Majesty.
Well, yeah, he's Royal Bobness. That's right. There you go. You've got it. Bobness. I just thought this was a lovely story because I don't know if people are well aware of the fact, but he's recently bought a house in Scotland, a massive house in Scotland.
Is he really?
Yes, a really big mansion house. And I
whereabouts?
Think.
Do we know?
Yeah, I do, actually. Inverness, near Inverness, because I'm going to go there and I'm going to stake it out. I'm going to hide in the bushes until I see him.
Right.
Not that I'm obsessed with him or anything like that.
Didn't he write a song about Inverness?
Well, I tell you what. Well, he didn't write one about Inverness.
20s. Hang on, what was this?
Hang on, this is going to be rude.
No. I'm sure he wrote. So anyway, go on. Yes.
No, Be rude. If you want to be rude, it be on your head. Be it if we have to cancel the whole show. And he didn't write anything about virgins, if that's what you're going to say.
The word never escaped my lips.
No, because it came out of mine by accident.
Well, read my lips.
Oh no. Anyway, he bought a house and it's near Inverness. And the song you're talking about is called Highlands.
Right.
He actually wrote a song about the Highlands, and that's where I thought you were going, yeah.
Was,
my heart is in the Highlands.
No, I was in the Highlands last year, actually, but I'm not going at the moment.
I read that's where Eric is.
Right.
just about to land. So his really famous house in Point Doom on the coast of that place where all the famous people live in America. What's it called, Mark? Help me out.
California.
No, on the beach.
On
that
the
famous beach.
Bondi Beach.
No, not Bondi.
That's Australia.
Everybody lives who's famous and rich.
Clacton.
Oh, you're about as helpful as a kick in the. Anyway, his house there, right, with all the millionaires and all the multimillionaires and all the stars.
All right.
He's next to somebody who else is famous and somebody.
How can he afford to live there?
Because he's a millionaire, you know.
Is he?
Yes, he's made a lot of money.
He was just a humble folk singer called Bob Dunn.
No, he's got houses all over the world, and he has one in New York, and he's going to settle down there.
Do you know that he nearly bought one in Muswell Hill? You know that story, do you?
Do with that bloke out of the Eurythmics, Dave Stewart.
There's actually the story from the woman who had the house up for sale, and she couldn't believe it. She opened the door. That's right. He turned up next to the estate agent in Crouch End in North London. She was just nearly fell over with shock.
I know. I think he's brilliant. He's like that, you know, because he got caught wandering around Liverpool. He took a bus trip to go and see John Lennon's house.
Oh yeah.
And he got on the bus and went down there. And then he was out in somewhere else in America trying to find Bruce Springsteen's house. And he looked a bit rough and a bit of a mess, as he sometimes does, because he tries to hide who he is. And he got arrested. And
really? Nobody
believed he was Bob Dylan. Yeah, he actually got arrested. The people from the hotel he was staying at had to come down and vouch for him. Anyway, you can hear Eric telling me to wind on if he was there, can't you? Anyway, all I was going to say is that I saw some pictures of his house. Inside his house, and what a lovely, lovely place it is, ladies and gentlemen. It's up only for $4 million. That's all it's up
like,
for.
It sounds like pretty cheap, actually, I have to say.
Well, he had a lot of trouble with it when he first bought it because he went a bit mad with his house. I don't mean he went mad personally, but he went a bit mad with his house, and he built this massive green dome on top of the house, and that's still there. And apparently, inside it, he has suspended from the ceiling his car.
No.
And the lounge is so big that he said that he wanted to be able to ride his horse through the lounge. So it's a bit messy on the floor, a bit like the streets of Paris.
You know, I've never had him figured for that kind of man, you know. I had him sort of much more sort of quiet and sort of sedate, even in his private lifestyle. So these kind of things really surprise me. I mean, these are the kind of things that are sort of on the same level as...
that person you can't... Do you think we've contracted old people's disease?
Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson?!
Well, you know, Michael Jackson was, you know, very, very extravagant and very, you know, very over the top in his lifestyle. I just never expected a Val Bob.
I don't think it's being over the top his lifestyle because he can ride his horse through his lounge.
Hmm.
I went on.
Does Michael Jackson look like Thriller yet?
Well, that's about, yeah, I'll tell you what.
Maybe that's probably an unkind thing to say.
Should we move on?
Because yeah.
We haven't got a lot to go. And no. I think we're... To now look at something which is terrible. I think this is absolutely despicable. Do you remember Ken Barlow out of Coronation Street? Ladies and gentlemen who are not in the UK, You might not know who Ken Barlow is, but he was once described as the world's most boring man, and as the character in the play, not the actor. And I could never agree with it, because he took, I think it was the Sun newspaper, or one of the newspapers, to court for describing his character as the world's most boring man, and won! And won a fortune off him, yes! Anyway. Well,
for calling his character a boring man.
Yeah, unbelievable.
It's just amazing. Yeah. Anyway,
he's 79 years old, and he's now just started to brag about his sex life. And he says he's quite a good-looking bloke for 79 years old. I don't know if women generally tend to fancy people of 79 years old, but if you fancied a 79-year-old man, you'd fancy him. But he claims that he's had over 1,000 lovers.
That's an amazing number.
How many do you think you've had?
Well, a lot less than that. But I mean, I have to say that, you know, when you hear of that kind of level of encounter, I'm going to say, one then starts wondering whether, well, I mean, what was that film called? Shame?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it just seems extraordinary. And I don't know. And I haven't tried it. I haven't tried it myself. But I mean, it seems to me that at some point, maybe the value of it all becomes rather less than it might other.
So what you say, you could count yours on one hand.
No, he doesn't say that either.
I've had quite a wild and rumbustuous love life. And as a man, I'm really happy to be able to brag about that. I know women shouldn't brag about doing that, but women tend to today. And it is a thing that men should do, but at 79 years old, particularly when he starts saying that other legends of the show, like Pat Phoenix, you know, were some of his conquests and things like that. Why is he saying that? I can't see why a 79-year-old man who was once classified as one of the most boring men in the world and sued and got away with it, and I never thought he was boring at all. I thought he was fascinating.
You said hurriedly to avoid any further defamation writs.
Well, at 79, yes. He probably wouldn't bother, would he? But, you know, now this is terrible, and I'm sure Eric wouldn't let me say this, but his Lothario sexual appetite actually earned him the... No, I can't say it. Well, he's known as... What's his real name? Roach, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
There's
an insect, and he actually got called that. Yeah, and I think that's disgusting. We shouldn't discuss that. Anyway, he's been on that other Lothario's TV show, Life Stories, with Piers Morgan, and he's going to reveal all sorts of other things. Now, I think we're actually coming to the end of part one, and afterwards, I think we have something that is really dramatic, ladies and gentlemen. I don't know if you know about it, but there is a secret of Hillsborough. The disaster at Hillsborough has finally been revealed, and it just makes me wonder why it's been revealed now. We'll be back in... Before I'm trying to remember what you're supposed to say at this point. Go and make yourself a cup of coffee, and before you've had a milkshake or you've had cultured a yogurt, we'll be back, ladies and gentlemen.
Or another half a dozen conquests.
From the heart of Europe to the world, this is RTI.